please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, we are live right now with Breaking Banks. I am coming to you from my home studio in Connecticut today. That's because I've got to fly out to Los Angeles later tonight, and so I had to pack. But that's cool. We are still live. We have coming up on the show in a minute, Ben Milne from Dawala. He's going to update us on what's happening there. You'll hear from Dave Burt shortly. And also Vitalik Buterin and Simon Taylor from Barclays joining us, talking about blockchain in a moment. So a really interesting show for you guys today. Glad you could join us. Now, before we get to all that goodness in terms of those interviews, let me give you a couple of quick updates. Of course, you've seen in the news the big news this week, and we're going to be talking about this with both Dave and Vitalik. Craig Wright, is he Satoshi Nakamoto? Well, you know, he's backed away from this claim a little bit this morning, you'll notice, but I'm not going to spoil the fun for you, but there's some interesting theories floating around in the blockchain community about who Satoshi Nakamoto is, and you're going to hear about that today. Definitely conspiracy theory rumor mill time today. But before we jump into that, in terms of some of the other stuff that's happening, of course, blockchain is really hot right now. There's a lot of stuff happening. We're going to talk about the conferences that have been going on around blockchain in a moment. But before we do that, just quickly, just coming up next week, don't forget Finovate in San Jose, California next week, 10th and the 11th. I'll be there. Surprise guest is going to join me on stage at Finovate. You guys won't want to miss that. And don't forget, on the evening of the first day of Finovate, the 10th, Tuesday, we have a special exclusive launch party for the new book, Augmented. It's going to be an amazing event. Robert Scoble's going to be there. We hope Tori Belleci, Mark Andreessen, a bunch of other guys, celebrities, will be there. We've got a couple hundred people coming to that. If you're listening to the show right now, that means you're invited. Okay, so if you're in the Bay Area, check that out. Go to Eventbrite and search Augmented Life in the Smart Lane or just Brett King. You should be able to find it. And of course, we'll tweet it out on our Twitter feed as well today, so you can check that out. I would love to see you there. If you come along, I'll give you a copy of the book. I might even sign it for you. Now, don't forget also the day after Finovate on May 12th, we have NextBank USA. You can register there and use the discount code. BreakingBanks20 to get a discount on that, and of course on Finovate as well. And we also have coming up in St. Louis, Missouri on June 14th. We have the Distributed Trade Conference by BTC Media. So check that out on Eventbrite today. So who do you think is do you think Craig Wright is Satoshi Nakamoto? So here's the interesting thing. He came out of this earlier in the week and sort of said, all right, it was last week. I am Satoshi Nakamoto, and there's some evidence that was presented to this. It lends a little bit of credence to the fact that he could actually have been. There's stuff that he knows and stuff that he was involved in, but there's some conflicts around the whole private key stuff that's involved in this. So he's pulled back from that today, saying it's just too much pressure to take on. And you know, given Bitcoin's history and blockchain's history, there's so much interest in this. But Maybe part of this is just this mystery is better left alone. I don't know. But anyway, so let's hear what Dave Birch. Dave Birch came into the studio earlier in the week in New York, and we had the opportunity to ask him who he thought was Satoshi Nakamoto. Along with Dave Birch in the studio, we had his colleague, which is Salome Parulava, Sally, and they were talking about digital identity on the blockchain and the consensus conference that they attended in New York. So, Matt, let's run the interview from Dave Birch.
Hi, we're back in the studio with Dave Birch visiting from Londonanium or whatever. What was the old name for London?
Londinium.
Londinium. And Sally Parulava. Welcome. So you're, of course, both from Consult Hyperion, but you've been here for the consensus event talking blockchain. So,
yeah.
But it's always great to have you on the show, Dave. That's what do you think of – so it's rainy in New York today, but you like being back in New York?
I love being back in New York every time.
How many times a year do you come to New York?
A few. I mean, since we opened our office here, I've come over probably once every month, once every 2 months.
Yeah.
And there's always something fun going on. So
how is the office going? You're making some money?
Yeah, in fact, we've just gone mad and started hiring some more people. So it's really rather exciting.
But it's great. So what was consensus like?
Well, consensus was pretty
It was supposed to be a blockchain Bitcoin
event,
right?
Well, last year it was a Bitcoin conference.
Right.
And it was a lot smaller. And this year they've turned it into a blockchain / Bitcoin conference, which is much bigger, like 1,500 people or something.
So Michael J. Casey, our Bitcoin correspondent,
he was there.
Blockchain correspondent, was there.
It was interesting, I think, for a couple of... So we both chaired panels there, which is what we're doing over here. So yeah. I chaired the panel on identity. Sally chaired the panel on post-trade. And if you look at what was going on in the hallway, that's it, when people weren't talking about who is Satoshi. Because, of course, this broke on the first day of it. And so that's the first morning taken away.
Do you think he is, by the way?
I think he's somehow connected with it.
Yeah.
But so the conspiracy theories that were swirling around this morning was that actually he is part of the gang that is called Satoshi.
Yes.
But actually he doesn't have the private key because the private key has vanished or some guy died or...
Right. There was a group.
So imagine, this is how happy I was yesterday. I was delighted to be invited to host the panel about identity. As you know, I'm convinced that identity has a big part to play in the future of blockchain and shared ledgers. I'm very happy to be invited to that panel. The panel opposite me, Gavin Andreessen, on the day that Satoshi is revealed.
Oh, seriously?
I'm like, unless King Kong actually starts climbing up the end, this cannot get worse for me. No one's going to show. But I was happily wrong. There were a lot of people there who came on the identity side. I would say there's a couple of things that listeners probably want to take away from this. So one is that, first of all, blockchain has become this weird word, which is completely detached from its technological, like I'm a nerd, so to me, blockchain means something specific. Now blockchain just means anything that's vaguely to do with shared something or other. I don't even know, right?
Yep.
And so a lot of the stuff that was being talked about, like not only was it not blockchain, a lot of the stuff that was being talked about wasn't even really shared ledgers. It was just sort of weird techno-utopianism. But anyway, there were some really interesting panels.
So let's talk about, Sally, let's talk about your panel. What is post-trade?
Well, when the trade happens in financial markets, there are several stages it goes through. So you have pre-trade, you have trade, trade execution, and then... post-trade. So when trade is actually cleared and settled, so when you know that you got your security and I know I got my money, this is post-trade.
And so what role does blockchain have to play in the post-trade world?
Most of the people in the panel spoke about transparency characteristic, which is a promise of the distributed ledger technology. And this transparency bit could be very important for financial markets, especially after 2008. So actually the title of the panel was How to Prevent Next Lehman Brothers.
Good. So transparency is really undervalued, isn't it, Dave?
So transparency as an emergent property of blockchain, I think, is turning out to be more important than you think at first. So a lot of people were looking at blockchain. Can we reduce the costs of some payments? Can we reduce the costs of some clearing and settlement, stuff like that? When you begin to delve into it, it's not that clear that the cost reductions might be as big as people think, because so many of the costs are not technological.
Right,
they're
exactly.
regulatory and KYC and this kind of thing. However,
which is why you said that it may be more suitable that blockchain becomes a reg tech than...
I think this is true, and not just as a soundbite, because if Sally's thinking on this is correct, I'm pretty sure it is, then the potential for more transparent financial markets to bring in new kinds of regulation that would radically reduce the costs of regulation and compliance and auditing, that's a big change.
That's a big deal.
And those are the costs for most banks. Those are the costs that are out of control.
Yeah.
The costs of technology are too high, but they're not out of control. The costs of regulation...
Well, compliance is 70% of IT investment right now.
The new IT
big banks. So let me ask you this to wrap it up, Dave, because you know we're running out of time. We've got to get to some proper guests.
They'll be here in a minute, I'm sure.
Yeah. So when we talk about the whole blockchain thing, there's a ton of hype around this. So when you were at this event, which is sort of we're at the nexus of the hype, it's blockchain in New York. What people actually knew what they were talking about, understood blockchain?
Oh, that's a horrible question. Okay, look. I think there was certainly a large number of people there who'd come along to learn about the technology and you know
were experts presented as experts on the stage, what would you say, 50-50?
I'm not going to be mean. I think this is in its early stages, and there are a lot of people up there who are putting forward versions of the blockchain world that I wouldn't necessarily agree with.
Right.
I think I would go so far as to say that.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, Dave Birch and Sally from Consult Hyperion, thanks for joining us in New York while you're visiting.
Thank you, Red.
See you next time.
So that was the interview we did earlier this week with Dave Birch. Always great to have him on the show. What do you guys think? Do you think we should have Dave as a guest host? I think he'd make a great guest host. So why don't you guys, if you think Dave would make a good guest host, put it out on Twitter, let me know, and we'll see what we can arrange for that, because I think he'd make a great guest host. Maybe we could do a show on identity, you know, something like that. He'd be good for that. Anyway, this time, what I'd like to do is invite back to the show one of our very first guests to Breaking Banks. He was on the second episode of Breaking Banks ever, and he's back on the show today. It's Ben Milne, the founder and CEO of Dawala. Ben, welcome back on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No, it's great to have you back on. So for those that don't know Dawala, I mean, Dawala is obviously one of the best-known fintechs in North America. But for those that don't know you, because we do also go out on the AM band, tell us about what Dawala does and why you started Dawala.
Well, Dawala is a purely digital payment platform, and the reason the company was originally started was really to help e-commerce businesses accept payments from their customers and not pay interchange fees. And since then, we've evolved in a whole bunch of different directions, built a lot of different products and tools, and more recently, really at the end of last year, we opened up a new white label suite of APIs and have really been focused on building out our sales team, selling those APIs into the market.
Now, you guys have actually done pretty well. You've raised some money, and so can you sort of give us an update? How much have you raised so far? How big is the team? Where are you guys based?
No, we've raised a little over 30, I think, so far. Team's about 50 total. I believe 40-ish are in Iowa, and then around 10 or 12 are in San Francisco.
And so you split the Iowa team's dev and the San Francisco team's business, or how does it split?
A lot of the engineering team is in Iowa, and I think that's really a function of that's just really where the company started. And so as we've built out those teams, they've just sort of stayed in Iowa. We opened up the San Francisco office to really help build out a management team after Andreessen Horowitz invested, and there's some obvious groundswell around the leadership team in San Francisco. I spend most of my time in Iowa these days, but go back and forth when I can.
Cool. So, in terms of Dawala, you have some bank partnerships, don't you? Or some traditional FI partnerships?
Yeah, we absolutely do. Dawala is really structured in a way where Dawala doesn't take ownership over customer funds. And so really working with financial institutions is part of what the company does, and it's part of our DNA. It's part of our business structure. And so as we continue to grow, nationally and start looking at really international opportunities, that's something that I think we're going to continue to do.
Now, you talk about Dawala as a,
I guess, as a secure payment network, a digital payment network, and you know, on the website it says the ideal way to move money. You know, when you talk about e-commerce payments, you also enable people to send money to each other instantly, digitally, right? Real-time payments.
We do, and you know, really, the way that we look at payments, it's all node-to-node, any-to-any, and
right.
So it's the same software, whether or not it's a consumer paying a merchant paying another business, it's just accessed through a slightly different portal, and really through a lot of the white label APIs, our customers are accessing and leveraging our infrastructure. They're just putting their name on it and building great experiences. But at the end of the day, it's really the same technology and the same software utilized for a number of different applications.
Now, you know, the U.S. is sort of a little behind the eight ball when it comes to real-time payments. And, you know, there's this ACH infrastructure that's internally built in for bank-to-bank transfers in the U.S. But, you know, that can take sort of 3 to 5 days to send money from one bank to another. Whereas in much of Europe today and places like Singapore and Hong Kong, a lot of those payments are instant or near real-time payments today. So why is it that the U.S. has been so slow on real-time payments across electronic channels, do you think?
I think a big part of it has been a lack of a mandate. I mean, if you think about it, there just isn't a requirement to adopt a faster payment system. At this point, I think the Fed's doing a really nice job sort of bringing all the collaborators together and is really making it clear and pulling everyone along to bring a faster payment system to market. But I do think it's taken us a long time because there hasn't really been a clear leader pound the table and say, this is what we're going to do, this is how, and this is by when, until the Fed has sort of stepped up and started to take on this faster payments initiative. You know, whether I like it or not, going somewhere and talking on a stage about the value of faster payments just doesn't have the same effect as the Federal Reserve saying, look, guys, this is what we're going to do.
Mm. Now, because that's an interesting difference between the U.S. and, say, the European Union. Because in the European Union, they're very open to adoption of standards. But the problem in the U.S. seems like you've got to get consensus before you can implement a standard. Would you agree with that?
In its current state, yes. I mean, some would argue that maybe the Fed doesn't have the legal right to mandate a faster payment system be implemented
right.
without changing many other things. So it's not a simple statement of we will do this and you will adopt the system by this date. A lot of other things would have to change in the United States for that to happen.
Mm.
And, you know, we have an established infrastructure that works pretty well with ACH and wire. And so I think there's probably a little bit of a hesitancy to take on the risk of some of these new systems. But generally speaking, no one was bringing everyone together to say, again, this is what we want to accomplish. This is how we want to accomplish it. You have an opportunity to contribute to it. And the Fed is doing a nice job, and it's doing it through, I don't know if they're going to get full-on consensus, but I do think they're going to get participation and faster payment systems in the United States are going to get to market.
Yeah. You know, if you think about sort of the basic hygiene factor here, it's a pretty simple baseline or standard we need. It says, I've got my phone, I want to send you $50, and I send that, and you receive it instantly and see that you've received it. This has sort of got to be the baseline of where we're going, right?
Yeah, the technology is not really that complex. This is technically a solved problem. But socially, getting agreement and getting, you know, as close to consensus as possible and getting these products and services to market takes a ton of people. I mean, some of these banks that are large likely have teams bigger than the number of people that work at Dwolla, just analyzing the opportunity, the different vendors, the different protocols. And those people may have been on staff for years at this point. And so there is an amazing amount of social work to do to get these systems to be even considered, let alone stand them up and build them. There's also a lot of new discussion around interoperability, and I think that's really where a lot of the focus is from our perspective, and maintaining a seat at the table to make sure that we're really a part of the interoperability discussion, ensuring that these systems can talk to one another so they're actually useful.
Yeah. But I'm
bullish on Dwella, because at this stage, with $30 million in funding, with 50 people, you guys have built so far what the entire banking system that is behind ACH hasn't been able to pull off. So, more power to you. So tell me about, your October, you started rolling out white labeling. How's that going for you guys?
White label has been a great product for us. As we kind of have found, our niche with our white label product is really in helping small businesses get to market faster and helping big businesses reduce operational expenses. And, when Dwella launched, it took me 2.5 years to figure out how to legally do this and get the technology built to get into the market. And there's a lot of people that can do it faster, but frankly, even if it still takes you 6 months and you're blazing fast, we can still get you to market in 2 weeks. And what's the savings to your business or the opportunity cost to getting to market that much faster? I think that that's where we're finding a great fit and continue to get better at it every day.
I'll give you a good quote. So as I run Movin, and we have an enterprise business as well. It's not as simple as you guys in terms of integration, because it requires a fair bit of work. But our head of enterprise, a guy called Greg Mitbo, came up with a great phrase he uses with our banking partners, which is Movin bends space and time. Right. So, we allow you to launch this capability in a fraction of the time and a fraction of the cost that you could do it internally yourself. Do you like that one?
You absolutely nailed it. I don't know how many of your listeners have ever set up a third party ACH origination agreement, but it's painful. And then you have to figure out file formatting, then you have to figure out returns and corrections, then you have to figure out fraud management, data storage requirements. I mean, there's just a litany of things that you really have to get great at and become a world-class at to build a great platform. And those are things that you get inside of our white label APIs that, as you said, they bend space and time. It just makes something possible in a shorter period of time than was possible before. I would have never thought that having a great ACH API would be building great opportunities for Dwella, but these days it absolutely is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dwella as a company has got a fair bit of attention in the media of late, and you guys have done pretty well in terms of your traction. Let me tell you what's coming up for Dwella over the next 12 months. What do you got planned?
Well, a lot of the things we're focused on, again, are really just those white label APIs, adding additional features that make them easier to use for our business customers. One of the things we recently rolled out was a balance endpoint. If you think about business applications like lending, where all of us have to fill out an application and say, well, how much money is in our bank account? And there's a pretty cumbersome process for actually reporting that information and the software platform confirming it. We've made it easy to programmatically do that so that you don't have to guess. It can be confirmed instantaneously, and so the loan can be made and the business gets their money faster. Thinking about new features like that is a big focus for us. We're also working on some new dashboards that really become the central admin for some of these white label applications to track their customers and also what's going on their software platform. That saves them from having to build their own administrative tools as well. And so what we really think that we're doing here is just continuing to double down on saving those businesses time and money and creating more value for them.
Yeah. So I've got to ask this because it's so hot right now, the blockchain. What do you guys think about the use of blockchain in terms of bank-to-bank payments in the medium term?
Well, I think there are certainly ways in which it can be used. There's no doubt about that. And from my experience talking to financial institutions, really they're trying to solve a problem for them, and what database type they use is really a function of what problem they're trying to solve. And so, I've written a lot about this and tried to sort of put it out publicly, but generally speaking, businesses and developers are going to choose the database structures that solve the problems they actually want to solve. And there are certainly new ways of solving problems when you have a view all public database, which is distributed amongst all members, which is immutable. It's a super cool technology with a lot of applications. I'm excited because I think over the next 12 to 18 months, we're really going to start to see some real business cases emerge here where companies are going to be selling some great products in the market. It's going to be providing end users with value, and a blockchain is going to be a big part of that.
Cool. So just to give you a heads up, we just had a tweet out from at CX Officer, which is Derek Corcoran from Avoca, and he said, after today's show on Breaking Banks, I'll be contacting Dwala to talk about a partnership. Thanks. So there's a little bit of a heads up for you from the Twitter feed.
We appreciate that. Happy to help.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of what's happening in the world of payments and so forth, there's some talk about, you know, the SWIFT hack in Bangladesh and so forth. There's concerns about security and so forth. So how's Dwala dealing with this? I know you guys are also working with the Fed on the Faster Payments Initiative, but, you know, what are you guys doing in terms of ensuring that Dwala's network remains secure?
We do partake in the security task force and also the primary task force. But generally speaking, you know, working on an internet-first platform gives us the ability to leverage things like tokenization and a lot of internet-first technologies to solve problems instead of having to solve maybe some things that were built into the system 30 or 40 years ago.
Right.
And our technology stack just is not that, I'm going to call it, I want to say experience, but it's really old. It's just our technology stack isn't that old yet.
Yeah.
So we're able to follow a lot of best practices, and I think it's an interesting time with all the discussion around encryption and everything else going on that there's no doubt advancements there are going to need to be discovered and also implemented quickly. And operating a digital-first network really gives us the opportunity to find new advancements and integrate them quickly. We have some really great folks on our security team that we think are doing some great work.
So I do want to talk to you about, because we've got about 3 minutes, a couple of minutes before the break. So I wanted to talk to you about, you know, Google CEO and Microsoft CEO recently have been coming out talking about bots taking over from the app world. And there's clearly a movement towards voice-based or machine-based commerce, which is sort of acting on behalf of us, agencies, if you like, agents-based that can do payments and commerce on our behalf. So as we start to move to this tokenized world where the 16-digit card number sort of disappears, how are you guys thinking about evolving into that world to handle agency or bot-based commerce?
You know, the beautiful thing about thinking about the world as sort of an API-first opportunity is APIs accept instructions from software applications. And if there's a voice UI instead of a form UI on the other side of that set of instructions, we're completely agnostic to that.
Right.
And so we're sort of looking at this from the perspective of we're excited to see who's going to build some of the first white label applications leveraging voice as a UI, but it won't change our technology. It doesn't change how it works, and it won't change the way that we communicate with our customers or how they communicate with their customers other than, you know, really the UI is different. So from my perspective, it's just a different way for people to interact with software, but we're kind of set up for it out of the box, which I know is kind of a boring answer, but it also might be kind of the benefit of just taking an API-first approach.
But it's also probably the benefit of designing a payment system on the IP rails instead of trying to jerry-rig something that was built 40 years ago based on check transfer and then got turned into electronic, right?
I would agree with that. I am not envious of the individual managing that system. I think we got a great opportunity to continue to do things in a way that is real-time first, that puts, you know, security at the top of the conversation rather than hidden behind. You know, I think there is still a great opportunity in payments to make things better, and in particular in the United States, even though this sort of faster payments initiative is not unfolding at the speed in which we would like, there's certain progress there, and especially with, you know, the Fed taking a proactive role, I'm excited to see what comes out of it.
Absolutely. So where can people find out about Dwala, and more importantly, where can they find out about your API initiative?
Really, if you just go to developers.dwala.com. There's some different libraries and documentation there that makes it pretty easy to get what you want. In the event that you don't find it, there's a public help forum that allows you to post any questions. And if you still can't find it, feel free to shoot us an email and we'll get you to the right people.
Fantastic. And I hear you guys have got some big news coming up next week, so I'll be watching for that as well. But thanks for joining us on the show, Ben.
Well, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
No problem. So check out Dwolla. That's dwolla.com and developers.dwolla.com, as Ben said. We'll tweet out those links on the show Twitter feed. But before we head to break, thanks again to our sponsor, Temenos. The Temenos Community Forum in Barcelona, May 17th and 19th. We'll be covering that. We'll be right back after this short break with Simon Taylor of Barclays and Vitalik Buterin of the Ethereum Project talking about blockchain. See you in a moment. Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
Consult Hyperion is a boutique payments consultancy based in New York and London, which helps clients deal with the rapid changes happening in the payment space. We deal with EMV optimization, helping issuers, acquirers, and merchants deliver value from their EMV investments. We help with the technical challenges involved in the digital transformation of payments through tokenization and mobile devices, and with the business cases behind the development of future payment technologies such as the blockchain and instant payments. Come and find out more at www.chyp.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, so we're back in the studio this week and we have visiting us all the way from, well, where are you based, Vitalik?
I move around a lot.
You move around a lot. You live in a trailer home then? No.
duffel bag.
Okay, so we have Vitalik Buterin, who's the founder and CEO of Ethereum?
Kind of. Well, chief scientist.
Chief scientist, okay. And Cy Taylor, Simon, how do we describe you now? Because you're in a transition.
Well, so I'm head of R&D for blockchain at Barclays, very much so. And that's a fun gig. I can explore with blockchain all day, every day as a full-time job.
But this is a fairly new thing for Barclays to be into. I mean, there are a few months you've been into it, right? But
yeah, I think publicly we've done some stuff in the accelerator before, but we haven't really shown some big hands. Recently, we gave a bank account to Circle Internet Financial and we did our smart contract template. So it's more of a coming out rather than we're talking to startups. It's more of a here's what
you don't want to use that terminology when you're in the US. It's very
that didn't work as well as I hoped. Oh well,
that's fine. So what brings you guys to New York? Why are you in New York this week?
Coming to Consensus Conference, meeting a bunch of people.
Yep. And so Consensus is an event on blockchain and Bitcoin?
Yeah, blockchain, Bitcoin, smart contracts, Ethereum, distributed, whatever.
Fantastic.
Consensus is run by Coindesk.com.
Right. So one of the big players in the Bitcoin / blockchain distributed ledger
space. They're one of the most well-known news sources, and their theme this year is making blockchain real. And it was interesting to me that right at the beginning, they did a poll of the audience of kind of how many people here are here for Bitcoin, and like three hands went up, and how many people are here for blockchain, and like the whole audience room went up. So the transition in the audience of who's going to these conferences was really interesting.
So just from a novice perspective, if someone's listening that doesn't know what blockchain is, then how would you describe that, Simon?
I'd describe it as the world's best auditor, or a distributed database. So like if a piano fell from the roof and only I saw it and I ran out of the room and said, hey, a piano just fell from the roof, would you believe me or am I just a crazy guy? Now, if a piano falls from the roof and 300 people run out of the room screaming, saying a piano just fell from the roof, you believe them instantly. So distributing information creates credibility, creates transparency in a way that's really, really powerful. So I think that distribution of information and that auditability of information is one key component. There are others, but that's kind of my my de jure kind of choice of how to explain it at the moment.
And if you're listening to the show right now and a piano has fallen off your roof, give us a call. We'd really like to hear about it. But that's a good illustration. I like. See, that's why he's the communicator, Vitalik. He can sort of put things in simple terms. So that's good for radio. So you built up a visual picture of a piano falling off a roof, and now that describes blockchain. So if we were to talk about the blockchain world, then how many people do you think are involved in blockchain around the world right now? It's pretty hard to sort of guess.
It's kind of like when people try to measure how many Esperanto speakers there are. Like, you have to figure out what the threshold is, right. And depending on what you choose, it's somewhere between like 5,000 and 1 to 10 million.
Yeah. So it's gaining a lot of popularity right now.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody in the C-suite that hasn't heard of blockchain yet. Exactly. And for me, the big transition of the last 6 months is that the C-suite water cooler conversation has turned to blockchain. Yeah. And that's good and bad, right? So now there's pressure and there's expectation. But at the same time, it's a wonderful opportunity for those of us that have been trying to get things done in this space for quite some time. Yeah. And good sunlight for this subject.
Absolutely. That famous Dilbert comment where his boss comes in and says, we need a blockchain. And he says, what color do you want that blockchain? Yeah. You know, so and
Mauve has the most RAM.
That's it. Mauve has the most RAM. Good. Now, blockchain, of course, has an application in terms of things like payments. And we've seen Bitcoin on top of blockchain to enable the distributed ledger for settlements of Bitcoin transactions taking place around the world. But what are some of the other things that we're exploring, particularly Vitalik, in terms of Ethereum? What other applications of blockchain technology do you think hold the most promise?
Going beyond Bitcoin, first of all, there's a bunch of other assets that people want to put on the blockchain, and this could range from, issuer-backed assets, putting dollars on the blockchain, to potentially company shares, to even potentially things that are kind of like assets, like domain names, even like land titles.
Well, if you think about it, the domain name system is very much like a distributed ledger, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah. The design's probably a bit more centralized than most blockchain people would like, but definitely that kind of
version
spirit.
0.4.
Right.
So let me ask you, I have to ask you, this is very topical right now. Everyone's going to be talking about it. And with having two of the greatest blockchain experts in the world in the studio, what about this guy who's claimed now he was Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin? What are your thoughts? What's his name, Craig?
Right.
Craig Wright, right? It's Aussie guy, by the way.
It's interesting that his name is Craig Wright because he's probably wrong.
Right. So, if you're inside the blockchain community, what's the buzz on this?
So the situation is that last year in November, this guy named Craig Wright, like there was some hubbub and there was this article, I forget where, it was either Wired or New York Times or something, where he said that, this guy is Satoshi. And then it quieted down a bit because he was pretty much not able to provide any evidence. And then
except the Australian Tax Department went after him for holding all this Bitcoin.
Right. So
they must have thought something about this.
Right. So then 5 months later, probably starting at the end of March, there was a sort of noise that I was kind of hearing in the background that there was going to be some kind of big revelation. And then what happened, like the night before the first day of consensus, was that this big media splash came out basically saying that there is proof that Craig Wright is Satoshi. And what this proof consists of is a couple of things. One of them is that Craig Wright on his website wrote this big long blog post. It was like this 200 line long thing where I tried to like read through it. I couldn't really figure it out. It spent way too much time like talking about what public key cryptography is rather than just providing, you know, a simple straight, here's the signature, here's the proof, verify it. Even like Ben Kaminsky, who's a world-renowned security researcher, thought that it was too confusing. And eventually, you know, the Reddit community found like 10 different like errors, mistakes, typos in some of the code. On top of that, he managed to somehow convince in private ceremonies like Gavin Andresen, John Matonis, and a couple other people that he is Satoshi, and they sort of came out publicly saying they were convinced that it's him.
Wow. For those of you that don't know who Gavin Andresen is, Gavin Andresen essentially built the current Bitcoin architecture, and then John Matonis was, of course, the chair of the Bitcoin Foundation
for a time. Yes.
For a time.
You know. Now, just to clarify for the audience, the Bitcoin Foundation is an organization with a substantially murkier history than its name implies. But let's go on.
True.
Yeah, I would echo Vitalik's views in that when you look at a lot of Satoshi's early work, it was flawless, and it was known for being flawless. And now, when somebody comes out and is making so many mistakes, maybe they haven't had as much time to, you know, remove flaws. That's plausible, but it just doesn't feel right.
The thing is that if he was Satoshi, he had access to a very simple and unambiguous way of proving that it was him. And that approach is just come up with a signature, anyone can verify it. Instead, what we have is this long blog post, and we have this really convoluted proof path by going through Gavin and John, which is like completely 180 degrees counter to the spirit of Bitcoin. Exactly. Like the spirit of Bitcoin is you verify the proof. You don't do this like appeal to authority thing. Then on top of that, one of the signatures actually isn't even actually a signature. Like, it was billed as a signature that's supposed to prove that it was him. Actually, it was a replay attack. Like, basically, what happened was he took some signature that was just made as a message in the Bitcoin protocol back in 2009, took that signature, and then sort of pretended that this was something that was just newly signed by him a week ago.
It's like taking somebody's old check, photocopying their signature, and then reusing that signature 5 years later as if it was your own.
You're really good at these illustrations, Simon.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? Dave Birch was in the in the studio earlier, and he thinks that actually Satoshi wasn't one person, but was a group of people.
So, like, I've heard, in the context of this Craig Wright mess, I've heard this conspiracy theory that it was a combination of him and a few other people, and if it was him, one reason why sort of the collective that is Satoshi is acting irrationally is because they're, like, fighting each other internally and in some weird way, and they have kind of incentives against each other. But in general, like, the other reason why people were thinking that it was different people is just because they thought that it was a feat too impressive to be done by one person. I honestly disagree. Yeah. I mean, I think it's something that's, like, writing that piece of code and coming up with those ideas is well within the reach of one reasonably smart programmer. You just have to have the right combination of ideas and be in the right place at the right time.
So let me talk a little bit more about Ethereum in a bit of detail. So Ethereum, you've come up with your own interpretation of the blockchain, or how would you describe
that? Well, it is a blockchain, right? So first of all, one thing that you should know is that there's a bunch of Bitcoin people that like to deliberately talk about the Bitcoin blockchain as though it was the blockchain and conflate the two. That's like stupid. It's like, imagine if, you know, Ford somehow managed to come up with a marketing message that like car and Ford are synonyms. No.
Yes.
So there are many independent blockchains. Bitcoin is one, Ethereum is one, Dogecoin is one, you know, different private chains that are being done by banks or others. So, and sometimes these blockchains have different properties. So Bitcoin is a blockchain that is designed specifically for keeping track of transactions and keeping track of balances of units of our digital currency, and the digital currency itself being called Bitcoin.
Yep.
So there are other blockchains. So there was Namecoin, which tries to be a blockchain that keeps track of a decentralized domain name registry. Then in 2013, people got interested in this category, this concept of general like blockchain applications beyond Bitcoin. They started getting interested in like financial contracts, land title registries, dice games on the blockchain, like escrow notarization. And they started coming up with these sort of what I call Swiss Army knife protocols that had like 15 different transaction types, where each transaction type is for some different application. And what I realized was that, okay, this model works fine for now, but it's in the future, it's
going to get more and more complex.
Basically, every time someone comes up with a new application, you have to swap out the protocol.
Yes.
It's fundamentally unsustainable. Now, I was, you know, once again in the right place at the right time. The 8 months that I spent at the University of Waterloo before I dropped out, I spent studying programming languages. And
so you're a college dropout too?
Yeah.
I'm a college dropout too.
Excellent. Yay, yeah. College dropout high five. So the idea that, you know, a programming language is a nice thing to use as an abstraction to do just about everything kind of came naturally to me. Yeah. And so it was kind of, to me at the time, it was fairly natural that the next step is, instead of creating a Swiss Army knife protocol, you create a blockchain that contains and understands a programming language, and whatever application people wants to build, they can build it on top of this language.
Right. Protocols should be very, very simple. Mm-hmm. And actually, you should layer complexity on top of them. Think of yep. it as almost, you know, the more simple the bottom is, mm-hmm. the more complex the top can be. Like really simple foundations.
Yeah, exactly.
You just want concrete and rebar. You don't want like some massively complex,
yeah, I mean,
crazy thing.
Like sometimes people also say that, you know, Ethereum is kind of more a bad idea because it's more complex than Bitcoin. But what they don't realize is that if all you want to do with blockchains is like Bitcoin transactions, then yes, Bitcoin is the best approach.
Right.
But
yeah.
at the end of the day, you don't want to be comparing Ethereum against Bitcoin. What you want to be comparing Ethereum against is the kind of protocol you would have had to do had you actually tried to create a blockchain that had like 175 different transaction types for every possible industry.
Sure.
Like the more it goes up, then, you know, at some points the complexity of that layer would have just gone to the point where like you would have had security vulnerabilities every day.
Yeah. Trying to build things on Bitcoin was going to have a limited shelf life. Like Bitcoin
yeah.
does what it was intended to do exceptionally mm-hmm. well,
yeah.
but then trying to use it to do other things is very, very difficult, whereas purposely mm-hmm. building something that was intended to be flexible
yeah.
will be more flexible
yeah.
by, kind of by default.
Yeah, exactly.
And so let me ask you maybe a simpler question.
Mm-hmm.
Why Ethereum? Why the name? How did you come up with that?
I originally sort of came upon the name when I was looking through a list of elements from science fiction in Wikipedia, because I just wanted something that sounded
like
cool. Yeah, I mean, I came upon Ethereum, and one of the reasons I like it is there's this concept of ether, which is like scientists were thinking in the 19th century that, you know, if water waves travel through water and sound waves travel through air, then what do light waves travel through?
Yes.
And they hypothesized that there was this kind of medium that permeated the universe that through which light waves travel through, and it's this thing that's kind of invisible, but at the same time the world runs on it. And I felt that kind of concept was sort of fitting for what I was
sure.
trying to do.
Yeah, well, optic fiber runs the internet.
Yeah,
I can see that.
Yeah,
I can
definitely.
See that. So tell me about what you guys have been talking about at Consensus this week. What have you been debating or getting into?
Well, debating, I guess, Greg, right? But we've already covered that.
Okay.
Talking in general, I'm seeing a huge amount of interest in blockchain technology from different fronts. There's
it's a little bit chaotic right
it's
now.
It's multi-industry right now, and yes, chaotic.
Yes.
Like if you're in the energy sector, if you're in trade finance, if you're in shipping, if you're in agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Pretty much every sector except traditional West Coast large tech companies seem to be really diving
mm-hmm.
into this sector, you know, kind of full front, you know, kind of
mm-hmm.
straight ahead. And there was a really interesting example of renewable energy contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an asset class that's, you know, kind of somewhat opaque, has a lot of fraud, but is something, you know, where renewable energy is seen as very positive. People with kind of solar instruments are able to sell their own energy back and all of this kind of stuff. But if there's a lot of fraud in it, will it ever catch on? And that seems like a huge opportunity for fintech. But then when you've got your auditor,
I can understand it's a massive opportunity for energy. I used to write contestable billing applications for electricity retailers. Do you know that?
Yes.
You know, encoding and maps. And you essentially got the spot price that works like the stock market.
Yes.
So you've got futures contracts sort of mixed into it, right?
Yes.
So, you know, it's really complex to build code for that, because you're trying to mimic these contracts that are negotiated between large users of electricity and generators and networks. So
what if the contract
perfect.
Was the code?
Exactly. That's
yep.
what I was getting to. That's
yeah.
that's a huge opportunity.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that now there's many different kind of dimensions. Like there's are you in fintech? Are you in healthcare? Are you in trade finance? Mm-hmm. Actually, the interesting thing about the word, even the word trade finance, that there's a finance component and there's a not finance component. So there's a lot of applications that have combined the two. Like there's identity, there's IoT, there's finance in IoT payments. That's one dimension. The next dimension is basically, are you an established company? Are you a startup? Are you some open source project between, you know, semi-anonymous people working out of their bedrooms? Are you a company? Are you a DAO? Are you something else? Then are you, you know, using private chains or using the public chain?
So we talk about this. So we talk about the chains, you know. So why do we use the term, for those who aren't familiar, why do we use the terminology of a chain for these distributed ledgers that we're using?
So in general, the way that these systems work so far is that they, you know, there's a notion of a transaction, and the meaning of a transaction could be different in different systems. Then, so in Bitcoin, you know, a transaction is sending Bitcoins from one account to another, and in Namecoin, a transaction could be registering a domain name or transferring ownership. These transactions then get grouped into blocks via some process, and there's a bunch of, you know, fancy names for these processes like proof of work, proof of stake, PBFT, round robin consensus. But in general, all of these are kind of ways for many different computers in a decentralized network to agree on, to place transactions into blocks and agree on the order in which those blocks come and sort of constantly add blocks to the end of this kind of sequence of blocks.
So the block just chains together.
Yeah, kind of every, so far every block kind of cryptographically points to the previous block, and that's where the sort of notion of a chain comes in.
So I think about it like a block is a batch file, a batch of transactions, and you chain it to the next batch, and you chain that to the next batch, and you chain that to the next batch. And what the people who saw the piano fall did is make sure that the chaining, that order is correct. So you're making sure the order of those blocks or the order of those batches of transactions is in sequence, and everybody agrees to that sequence of transactions to prevent bad things happening in the system.
So we talk right now, the CEO of Google and CEO of Microsoft are talking a lot about bots. We talk a lot about AI, but there's a lot of talk about the potential for artificial intelligence to disrupt, you know, the advisory space, accountants, lawyers, financial advisors, where there's sort of repetitive human work around interpretation of processes or frameworks or contracts. So just explain for those that sort of trying to grasp that, if you're talking about an accountant or a lawyer and the contracts or the assets that they're dealing with, and how that might be done with AI. How does the blockchain fit into that sort of world where now you've got a, you know, two companies trying to execute on a contract, but it's built on code?
So let me give you an example. Some of you listeners may be familiar with the ISDA contract. So the ISDA is...
What's ISDA stand for?
The International Something Derivatives...
Swaps and Derivatives Association.
Swaps and Derivatives Association. So that is a standard legal agreement that's around about 90 pages. And assuming you've got all of the commercial negotiations done, which is a big assumption, but let's assume you've got that and you just need to follow the process. On average, for an ISDA member bank, that takes 90 hours just to go through the legal workflow process of moving that around, getting it signed, FedExing it. And this is in 2016, we're FedExing paper around the world. And that's crazy. You know, big banks for trillions of dollars per year. Well, Barclays did a smart contract template demo. So a smart contract, so it's very similar to Ethereum, where we took an ISDA and we worked with ISDA and we said, what would this look like if we did it in a smart contract and we agreed the code and allowed the code to do all of the clauses in the contract? So if this, then do that. If the price of oil goes below X, do sell, buy, whatever it may be. And we got about 90 hours down to 3 minutes.
Wow. So that's, in terms of the impact to organizations, this could be incredible.
Middle and back office is phenomenal. And really, notice I didn't say that the negotiation got slower. Like the humans that do the negotiating about what the price should be is the higher order bit, and where you want your teams to be focused and where you want your front office to be.
Just that's how you compete. With repetitive legally.
Who wants to do that?
You have to realize is, I think, is that in general, over the last 70 years, computers have gotten a trillion times better. Human labor has increased in price.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, guess which one you want to be kind of pushing most of your operations information stored.
So we were talking before the show, Vitalik, about we're both interested in AI, but we're also interested in this emerging area of biotechnology. So gene editing, health tech, incorporating technology into our body, these sorts of things.
The big prize is life extension.
Exactly, longevity, which is, you know, we're getting huge leaps and bounds in this at the moment. So let's think about, there's a lot of data that's going to be there. I mean, your genome is data, but your health results, for example, if you're wearing a heart rate monitor and that data. So from a perspective of someone's medical records or your health information and it passing to a medical algorithm that then can predict whether you're going to have a heart attack based on your heart rate data, could you see something like that fitting into a blockchain world?
So there's a couple of different challenges in the healthcare industry. I think one of the major ones is also privacy. One of the things is
blockchain is transparent.
Exactly. So the thing is, the word and sort of the buzzword cloud around blockchain just often ends up being non-technical people's first introduction into the concept of cryptography. And yes, cryptography can do really amazing stuff, like potentially allow algorithms to magically analyze your heart rate and just every single piece of data about your body and figure out whether or not you're going to have a heart attack, while at the same time preserving privacy completely so that the actual person or who's running the algorithm knows absolutely nothing about you.
Yeah.
And but, you know, that's a cryptography application. It's not a blockchain application.
Right.
So in general,
so what would be the blockchain implication in this example?
In general, right, there's different kinds of cryptographic technologies that provide different properties. Like, there's encryption generally provides privacy. In this case, if you want that kind of black box computing, you want either obfuscation or homomorphic encryption, which are basically fancy forms of encryption that you do more fun stuff with.
Now he's totally geeking out.
Yeah.
Blockchains are good for authenticity. So not for making sure that things are secret,
so to make sure that the data is sound and that it's your data and that the doctor is a trusted party.
Now, in those cases, where you want the data to be secret and correct, well, you can use homomorphic encryption on top of blockchains. So, you know, you can combine them together.
Sorry, homomorphic?
Homomorphic encryption. Yeah.
Homomorphic encryption.
Homomorphic encryption. Yeah. There you go.
Definitely want to look up if you're feeling like geeking out.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
I like to think of it as you can ask the cryptography a question and you get the right answer, but you don't ever see the underlying data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can confirm that the data is correct, but you don't have to know.
At the moment, it's still, you know, in the realms of computer science and theoretical computer science, it's kind of blurring between those two, because at this point, it's very good at, are you over 18, are you under 18, but it's very bad at, can you tell me thousands of data points and give me the correct answer on all of those? So it's still emerging, I think.
Well, okay, so just wrapping up, because we're running out of time. We could have had a whole show on this. This is very, very interesting stuff and very, very topical, of course. But let me just ask you both, I like to finish off the interviews with this. What's next for Ethereum over the next 12 months and for yourself, Vitalik?
I mean, there's a few different angles. So technologically, I think it's important to note that blockchain technology is not finished. There's still years to go in order to achieve the kind of scalability properties that we want. So Bitcoin can process 3 to 7 transactions a second. Ethereum can do 15. Actually changing the world is going to take 500,000. So how do we get from 15 to 500,000? We have a bunch of techniques, you know, called, you know, with names like sharding and state channels. And if you want to geek out more, feel free to look those up too. Homomorphic encryption is cool too. We're, you know, privacy is another major one. So like making sure the blockchain is efficient enough that these kind of privacy preserving technologies that I talked about can actually be combined with blockchains nicely, and you can kind of run the two together so that you can actually use the blockchain to make sure data is correct and use encryption to make sure that the data is secret at the same time.
So it's sort of like if you translate this to the internet world, we've got an IP network. We don't quite, we don't have Gopher on top of the IP network yet, but we're trying to figure out how to do that.
It's getting like there. That. Also, like, imagine the IP network of the internet of the 1990s, you know, was like 50 kilobytes a second, which was good enough for text, but it's not good enough for video.
Right.
So blockchains right now, they're good enough for recording marriages, but they're not good enough for, like, you know, global worldwide financial contracting networks, and we have to get there. On the usage and application side, I mean, there's been a lot of interest, and they're definitely sort of hoping to kind of help guide that along, and although it's just to some degree the community does, you know, a lot of those things by itself. Sure. And I think we're hoping to see lots of really interesting stuff come out in the next 12 months.
Fantastic. Well, Ethereum's
by all accounts, doing very, very well. So you should be congratulated. Amazing momentum at the moment, yeah. And it's been wonderful to have you in today, Vitaly. What about you, Si?
So the next 12 months, I think, starts where we started in January. So I don't know if you saw in February, the Government Office for Science released its blockchain report. I'd encourage your listeners to go check that out. It has a good view of whatever industry you're in.
I don't trust any government department has the acronym GOOSE as they named
it. Well, maybe this one might prove it wrong. Who knows? But actually, no, I'm focused on trying to make blockchain real. In Barclays, we've worked with a lot of startups through our Barclays Accelerator. We've done a lot of experiments. Now it's the rubber hitting the road. We want to get things moving, as I think a lot of banks do. You'll see in the smart contracts demo piece, and I think there's going to be more of that to come. I can't give specifics, but I'm really, really excited to start making this live data, live transactions, and kind of making the rubber hit the road.
Very good. Well, Si Taylor and Vitaly Buterin, thanks for joining Breaking Banks today and teaching us all about the blockchain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.